Welcome to this recorded session from the 2025 American Craft Sake Festival, hosted by the Sake Brewers Association of North America and Origami Sake in Hot Springs, Arkansas. In this talk, Lucas Smolik of the Sake Brewers Guild explores the past and present of Kimoto-style fermentation. Lucas is an engaging researcher who thrives on digging deep into the science and history of sake, and then bringing those insights to life with humor and approachability. He challenges long-held assumptions, revisits historical terminology, and offers a fresh take on what Kimoto means in the modern brewing landscape. If you enjoy this session and want to stay connected with Savannah for future festivals, conferences, and resources, visit sakeassociation.org to join our newsletter, or follow us at Sake Association on Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. So without further ado, let's listen to Lucas Smolik's presentation, Why is Kimoto?
All right, well, while Lucas is getting his technology sorted, I'll give a brief introduction. If you have not had a chance to meet Lucas, he's an outsized personality.
That's one way of putting it.
Yeah. Once you've met him, you've met him.
You've met him.
Lucas is a former software engineer and an entrepreneur who fell in love with sake brewing. He stumbled into an incredible opportunity to become the head brewer at Wetland Sake in New Orleans. And then motivated by his desire to study different approaches to and further his knowledge of microbiology and fermentation, he left to pursue part-time work in consulting and apprenticeships, which led him to work in 7 different sake breweries across the United States and Japan. He's currently consulting at Origami Sake, our hosts for this event, where he is working on some of their flagship brands, their non-alcoholic products, and their RTD product, Snow Monkey, which hopefully you got to try for the first time yesterday at our opening reception. Lucas is also the founder of brewsake.org, which is home to the Sake Brewers Guild, 501(c) nonprofit fostering a sake brewing community across 140 countries, which I believe you're going to tell us more about today as well. Mm-hmm. Excellent. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to Lucas for him to talk about why is Kimoto.
Why?
Is it a pencil logo in there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I made that.
Okay. I feel at home. Yeah.
All right. It's the yeast starter, formerly known as Kimoto. Okay.
And with that,
awesome. And you, is this how you're recording this, or can I just talk? Can you all hear me?
Yeah, I'm recording it down here. So,
excellent. Because I am usually just loud. So I know this is a weird title, but I think it makes sense because in a lot of ways there's a lot of curiosity about different things, flavors, and all that. What does Kimoto do? How does it taste differently? And I think with all the CERT courses and things that I've either attended or heard statements from, I kind of said, I want to know why. I always want to know why things are as opposed to just sort of hearing it. And a lot of the explanations didn't technically make sense to me, so I started diving into a lot of technical papers, but I'll get to that in a second. So last year, by the way, I'm like 10% more alcohol today than yesterday, so I'm going to be reading off of these. Also, I want to make sure that that I'm accurate about it, because I do think that's a challenge, is not saying something that's inaccurate when you're specifically trying to hit what is accurate. So last year I presented on a topic that absolutely captivated me. It had to do with the symbiotic relationship between Aspergillus oryzae and Saccharomyces sake. That was tracking their evolution through time and basically revealing that Aspergillus oryzae, when cultured in a liquid medium, will produce a substance known as yeast cidin, which is basically like a glycoprotein, or there's a few different ways I've heard it referred to. Basically, the thing about it was, if you cultured yeast, regardless, wild yeast, anything in this culture, only the species Saccharomyces sake would survive. And this became a way for flour yeast to be identified and other things because of the fact that only that specific species. Now, there's other things around that of vitamin requirements and things that would be used in the medium, but ultimately, it's an extremely exciting thing to be able to identify this. So anyway, this still remains a substance that is studied or at least used in research in universities within Japan. In fact, there's lots of different places will say we developed a new local yeast, we found a new flower yeast. Usually yeast cidins involved. Justin Potts and Ben Bell at Origami actually had Bruce Takano come from, he used to work at Yaigaki in California, who actually studied under Takeda-san, Takeda-sensei, I guess, who had actually written the first recipe down for yeast cidin. So it was really kind of cool to have that. He showed me his whole master's thesis he had written out. It was, I don't know why I had it with him, it's like 30 years ago, but it was so cool to see it and go through all the pictures. So today, by the way, this is from ChatGPT, and that's incredible that could happen. I just said high-fiving yeast and bacteria, and we got that. So continuing this theme of symbiotic relationships, today I want to talk about another fascinating tale of two organisms. This isn't necessarily specific to sake yeast, although many of the things are specific to sake. Kimoto is a style of sake, right? It's categorized by its co-culturing of lactic acid bacteria and yeast. And there's a lot of outdated or perhaps missing information, especially in English. So what I'm going to do is try to explain from my research on how, and in this case, why Kimoto is the why do we have this category of Kimoto? That's the point of this. Is I want to dig in a little farther and understand what are the benefits of using Kimoto as a yeast starter. So cool. Oh, and this is the other thing. Some of the stuff I'm talking about here, I'm gonna put it out here, but literally one of the studies I read was published 2 months ago. So it's some of this is actually cutting edge kind of stuff where the world of sake is still figuring out how does Kimoto really work, the organisms within it, what's going on in there. So I think it's kind of interesting. Anyway, so let's explore this topic together. Give a little quick intro myself. Nick already gave a great one, but I wanna note a few people, or at least one major person in my life that I wanna call out. So after that year and that 20 years in software, it's been about 5 years now that I've been really diving into sake after kind of homebrewing and kind of going into that commercial world and then seeing the commercial world and saying, I still don't really feel like I know enough. So 4 years ago at Sake Fest, this is why Sake Fest is actually a huge love of mine because of how it has influenced my career. I met Chiaki Takahashi, Chiaki Takahashi, which is the lady you see appearing in here. Our first year, this was Sake Fest in 2022, and I'll just say that I was glued to her passion. Every single thing she told me that weekend blew my mind, and she was so enthusiastic about it. And basically, I approached her and I said, obviously she's going to be introduced because she's next. But Dr. Takahashi is an expert in microbiology. She studied sake yeast at the NRIB. And among many, many resume items that are like, wow, I really think her best gift is her ability to take extremely complex things and whittle them down to something that like anyone can understand. And me being very new to this at the time, especially microbiology, I was like, wow, this is so cool. So my idea was I wanted to have her teach me. I was like, how do I make that happen? What's the goal there? She said, well, she would have me come down to Islander Sake in Hawaii and I'd work alongside them. And she did accept me. And so after I worked alongside her, Tama Hirose and Jun Shoji, which by the way, Shoji and I became pretty close. Shoji is, where is he over there? Shoji realized that his last name was Shoji and my name was Lucas. And together as a team, a brewing squad, we were Shoji Lucas, which sounds very much like George Lucas. So we had a great time. Anyway, it's always about the people you work with, really. Working there, I actually came away from that experience feeling like I really have a totally different way of looking at brewing. And a lot of the stuff, like last year with East Sidon, she told me about that. What I'm presenting on here, she incepted a lot of these ideas, and now I've gone out and said, okay, I gotta learn more about this. And the reasoning had to do with, I wanted to know what I don't need to worry about when I'm brewing. Right, there's all these things when you're starting off brewing, you're trying to figure out, are my temps right here? Did I sanitize that properly? Did I do this? And brewing with her just for a few months, I was like, oh my God, I see what you don't have to worry about. Not everything, but it really brought that to light. So then going forward, it was like, cool, now what do I specifically want to focus on? Anyway, so I guess what I'm going to say is my passion I'm sharing with you today, I really hope that I make her proud, because as my teacher, she inspired me to this, and I've worked very hard to kind of like make sure I'm following her footsteps as closely as possible. So I created Brew Sake in 2022, which was an idea of, or sorry, 2020, to kind of bring together all the information I've been learning over the years and share it with people. Since then, we actually have cultivated about 144 countries around the world. I leave these Zoom calls with people. We have had like about 14,000 people in the last year alone come to our site and learn from this. And I have to be honest with you, I've built lots of websites as a software engineer. I always had passion sites for this and for that. Never in my life have I encountered a topic that people just love and are so, so passionate about. So we just put this out there for free. People have joined, whether they join our Zoom calls, whether they're on a Discord, and I'll kind of have a few of these things. But our main goal here is we believe that, you know, learning to make high quality sake should be open and accessible to everyone. We think that the global mission of this, home brewing, is really important. Sorry, that's for the Tax Association. And it's a running gag. We just think it's important to get things out there. So this is a Discord that we run. We have lots of different forums and things that include lots of research papers, snippets from those, translations we've done. It's a big community, really. And as this has been growing over the last couple years, we've seen just this sudden inflection point where all of a sudden the experienced brewers are starting to shepherd the newer brewers that are coming in. I don't have to say as much. It's just like kind of rolling itself. And it's creating essentially, we were always looking for essentially what we felt Japan had, which was these guilds all around in different prefectures. And we said, why don't we have that? Like, where's our educational home? And so now we have that. And it's a place that we can be very honest with each other, show our failures, show our successes, show off sometimes, show the new brewing equipment that arrives, share sake. I've literally had sake flown to me from Italy, which is really cool. Get to try that one sometime this weekend. There's a guy up here, where's his name? This is Satori, coming out of Idaho, Idaho's first sake. I got to try his first batch. He sent me one, so we actually on the Zoom call, I opened it too with him. It's really cool seeing that kind of community come together. So I'm really proud of that. We ran these brewing seminars that were super successful. Once I started consulting with Origami, it took all of my time, so I didn't have any time to do these anymore, but we're gonna find a similar thing like this and continue them rolling. But these are all on our website, brewsake.org. They're also on a YouTube channel where we're cultivating all different things from around the web. In fact, if you're interested in trying to find resources, like I wanna watch how Koji's made in Japan or how a Shubo is done, I've tried to save all these playlists on there so you can go there and just look at what, even if you can't understand the Japanese, just visually seeing it really does help. So anyway, okay, we're gonna get to the actual meat of this, but I did wanna mention I am consulting here. This is a rendering I made of the building so we can actually lay things out and figure things out. But this is the current building now, and it is a monster. It is quite a production to see like 20, 30 people running around this on a daily basis, putting out an insane amount of sake, trucks of sake, literally going out the door every other week, go to the East Coast or the West Coast. It's exciting stuff to be down here helping out with this company and see what they're doing for Arkansas, for rice, and honestly, for sake in general. So, all right, let's talk this. I want people to give me answers. I just shout them out, this is quick. What is Kimoto? This is your audience participation part. I've been shouting out, what is Kimoto? I would take anything. Give me an idea of what it is, what it produces, what it's like.
It's pole ramming.
It's what? It's pole ramming. I think that's Yamaroshi. But yes, okay, anything. Does anyone know what Kimoto is? Raise your hand if you know what Kimoto is. Okay, that's good, all right. All right, we'll go into that. Does anyone know how lambic beers are made? Okay. And let's see, this is kind of one, this also has a fun thing to it. why is Kimoto yeast said to be strong? Like, why are natural ferments, why are they stronger than others? I've heard lots of explanations for this, but I'm kind of curious if anyone knows. Silence at 10 a.m. By the way, Daishichi has this on their website. Please go to it. Please read it. It is an interview between yeast and bacteria in their brewery. It is one of the greatest things I've ever read. I stumbled upon this like 2 days ago and was like, I'm sorry. You have a yeast cell interviewing your lactic acid bacteria? It's amazing. What did I call out? Oh, yes. This is one with a strong point of Kimoto is the quality of the yeast, which has been carefully selected in a competitive environment. And that is very much leading to the rest of this talk. And then why is Kimoto flavor said to be rich and funky? And these are just random quotes from websites of like, you know, different things where people said, well, this is why, this is how. So I guess I want to ask you if you know why it is. But that's the goal, is to talk about why that is. How do we get here? What is Kimoto? Blah, 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 blah. Hold on. I had a note there. I totally lost. Okay. Not all yeast cells. Sorry. I'm here. This is the 10% alcohol speaking. Okay. So Kimoto is a type of yeast starter, right? A yeast starter is basically like a cradle of life. Think of it that way. It's like you're trying to create a safe environment for your yeast cells to grow without any other competition. And realistically, at that level, you really can think of it as like warring cultures. You have a very small amount of food sometimes, and they're literally battling out for resources to survive. A friend of mine, Reed, who's a fairly prolific member of the guild, he once said that in beer and wine, our idea is to cultivate yeast. You just want a lot of yeast, because the whole idea is to just rip as quickly as possible as much alcohol as you can as quickly, right? It's what you want to do. In sake fermentation, we want to condition yeast. And so this is showing actually a Kimoto fermentation. It won't tell you where from or what it makes, but suffice it to say, this is a temperature graph of going up and down the product, and it is a concept of conditioning. That's one element of conditioning. So yeast need to be able to handle a very harsh environment as they go into back. You have everything from heat stress to alcohol stress. You have other organisms trying to attack them. There's a lot of things going on in there. So just to name a few of these stresses, and this is basically showing you a cell wall. And over here, I've listed a legend, if you will. These are all of the stresses that cells might have to, or some of them anyway, stresses they have to be prepared for. So when you think of your fermentations, obviously ethanol is going to come to light. I don't think we talk enough in this country anywhere about pH stress when it refers to sake. This is a huge deal, and buffering your pH up and down or being aware of how that affects your yeast, that actually comes into play in this, because part of what flavors are generated by yeast also has to do with the pH that they're in when they're generating it. So like I said, not all yeast starters are created equal. You have Sokujo. If anyone's taken a course or if you're a brewer, you probably know that Sokujo is the new modern fast yeast starter, which will add lactic acid to adjust the pH so we don't have bacteria growing in there or wild yeast. But Kimoto uses live bacteria to achieve that goal. So both achieve the same goal of adjusting the pH down in order to kill off wild yeast, kill off bacteria. But in Kimoto, we have this live bacteria, and that is actually a categorical difference. I don't always hear this, but I want to say it out loud, that Kimoto style is not the same as Kimoto, right? They have two different things. And then you have Sokujo, which is this fast style, and it is like using something that's been cultured in a lab, which is just a pure acid, versus something living in the actual mash when you're making it. So, this is fun. So if you get a chance, scan this. This is Aramasa's blog, and this is one of their articles, and I think this is a great one. You can get it off the slides when they send them around, but they actually explain how even Kimoto as a word is a relatively new word. Before that, it was known as Kanmoto, and there's a whole bunch of other iterations of this, Kanmoto being the winter brewing season, cold season. Because of the way the evolution of trying to make a healthy yeast starter, eventually figuring out that like Bodaimoto's like gets a little weird in the hot summer. Okay, doing it in the cold. Hey, this seems to be better. The quality's better. And so it's like shifting always towards what's a better quality, et cetera. But I do, please do read this because it does, they do a great job going through the history of it and how we arrived at the current state. So I want to throw that out. So what does Kimoto look like? Well, you've seen the polls. I'm sure everyone's seen a photo like this. Like, is that Gigi? Does anyone know? Julia, you know Gigi? No?
I think it's Gigi.
Anyway, this is Akita style. This is old style. I don't know if there's another name for this, but it's basically, we don't want to do this, so we're doing this. It's just, don't want to do it anymore. So this is the thing described as like long hours into the night, yada, yada, yada. And I do have a, I was wondering how much I'm going to try to go into this. I was going to go through like the Kimoto process. This is off of Nada Ken's website. Philip Harper did a nice job throwing this together, or whoever did. And I kind of broke this into three parts. But I wanted to make sure like, This image right here is showing one day of the Kimoto process. It's basically like three times a day, you do this for 20 minutes. And for some reason, that's been described as like the most heinous, arduous process in the world. And I'm like, hey, okay, but it's like 20 minutes, three times a day for one day. It's okay. That, however, much more fun. And I think we can all agree that is so much better. But I actually did do this process a few times myself. I've made a few Kimoto, both at a homebrew scale and a little bit larger scale. And it is a really fun process to see it all actually happen, look at it with your eyes, see the paste-like or not paste-like consistency of the initial mash. So when you see what they're doing here, I want to give a high-level overview of the process because most of you have heard most of how this works. But essentially, it's the same way you'd make any other shugo. You're going to soak, you're going to steam, you're going to cool your rice. The difference is you want to, in Kimoto, there is this one step that's a little bit difficult. When you put all that together, you don't want the rice to mush too fast. If it gets too much of a paste, the consistency actually makes it harder for the bacteria to grow. And so there are reasons why we have these steps, and I'm trying to highlight those specifically in here, not so much tell you how Kimoto is made directly. And I'm going to skip over Yamahai. I'm going to skip over Bodaimoto. Those things are like styles of Kimoto. This is just trying to get into the main process. And so day one, you're doing what's known as mototate. This is like to create this. So you're going to steam. You're going to leave the rice unattended after it's cooling down. And the process of that is to make it harder. And to make it harder means that when you start mashing it with those poles over here, it starts as kind of just rice, koji, and water. And it starts to become a little bit more liquid at some point as it breaks down. You don't want it to get so thick that, like I said, it becomes a paste. That's too much stress. So the nitrate-reducing bacteria will essentially not make it through. They'll die if they do that. Am I losing you all on this? I'm so sorry if I am. It's technical, I know, but we'll just follow me. Follow with me. We'll get there. Okay. Sorry, I wanted to go back to this one. So during brewing, the steamed rice goji. Okay, yeah. So you guys know when you've seen like a whole bunch of the hangiri on the floor, the barrels, like there's like six of them on the floor, and they're all doing like. That's actually done for a very specific reason. You do it to keep the temperature low. There's actually a point of exposing it to the air to some degree, but it's also you're trying to keep those so you can mash them in a very specific like. How do I want to put this? Yeah, it's mostly to keep it cool. And sorry, this part is a little bit jaunty, I apologize. So after you get all that together, you have about 100 kilograms of rice in each one, so it's a little bit easier to manage. If you're trying to mash an entire thing, it's a little bit harder, especially when that rice is so thick. But you're going to start around like 7 degrees Celsius on that first day, and then toward the end of that day, you do what's known as teimoto, which you've heard. You kind of mix that all together with your hands. And this is to avoid crushing the rice too much. Again, it all comes back to what are we trying to avoid? What are we trying to achieve? We're trying to avoid making it too paste-like so that our bacteria will ultimately succeed. Day two, I'm sorry, I'm not going to follow along exactly with this. Day two, we actually want to... Oh, this is when we start doing our Yamaroshi. So that picture of them kind of doing the poles and all that, or doing the grinding, this is when we're actually doing that. So now we're actually trying to break it down a little bit more. And this is also where, when you do Teimoto, this is where you're actually getting bacteria into it, in addition from the koji. So there's two places where bacteria enter into the fermentation. Largely, it's coming from the koji itself. When you're thinking in a room and you're making koji, it's in 30 Celsius, it's super humid, and that's where a lot of bacteria are gonna grow on that. So when you bring them into it, now you're bringing lactic acid bacteria, you're bringing wild yeast, you're bringing a whole bunch. And then your hands, your arms and all this, this is actually also where you have tons of lactic acid bacteria living on you. So you're bringing that right into the ferment. So this is basically to start breaking down the rice even more and helping to also, you're now starting to want to warm up the ferment. Bacteria have several different temperatures that they operate best at. And sorry, this is like, this part right here is really confusing to like describe out. So I'm just gonna read this through and I apologize. Okay, on day three, we're gonna combine all the tubs. We're gonna reduce down, bacteria are gonna reduce nitrates down to nitrites. This is a hard part of this, but it's really an important part. We have to make sure that we're reducing nitrogen in various forms down to something that yeast are happy with. So wild yeast will die off once you reach like 1% acidity. So what we want to do is initially have those wild yeast be killed off by nitrate-reducing bacteria, Pseudomonas. Pseudomonas are then replaced by lactococci, which will raise the, they're like round-shaped bacteria. They'll raise the acidity around one total acidity or titratable acidity. And then you have lactobacillus take over and then raise that even higher. So, sorry, this part is just hard for me to go through. Okay, I'm sorry. It's the alcohol. Okay, so like I said, on day three, we're combining all the tubs together to start warming it up. On days five and six, now we're increasing the temperatures by 2 to 3 degrees every single day. This is gonna help cultivate the lactic acid bacteria at a slightly higher temperature range. This is all gonna prevent too much saccharification. So every day you go up 2 degrees or 3 degrees, you come down a little bit. You're doing this temperature, you've seen that saw-like temperature spike up and down. The whole point of that is not to have too much sugar because that will actually inhibit the growth of lactic acid bacteria. Whereas if you don't have enough, they won't have enough food to eat. So you kind of like keep going up a little bit. When the nitrite reaction is ceased, so on day 13 here, on day 13, it's not necessarily day 13, but you're looking for a point when you're testing the nitrites, when they stop rising up, we know that it's safe for us to actually put our yeast in. So there's like various different levels to when it's like acceptable to do various things. So it's not necessarily a day, but it's more, we want to make sure that we're checking with our strips. It essentially means that the Pseudomonas are dead, the acidity is over a certain amount, it's safe to put this in. And the sheer amount of yeast that we're gonna put in will be so much that it's going to propagate very quickly into the shubo. And at that point, you're gonna start warming it up even more. They'll kind of do that on their own. So as I said here, you're gonna let it rest for a couple days. Fermentation heat will kind of raise the temperature on its own. And then finally, what we're gonna do is warm that up as much as possible, either using darus, which are like the metal, milk jugs or something like that to warm them up. Or you can use thermal tanks nowadays to achieve the same goal. But essentially there's like a temp spike that goes on, and this induces a lot of different stresses. Some of those stresses are gonna be heat stress. You're gonna generate a lot of alcohol on that day, which is going to create another stress. So all these things start killing off all unwanted bacteria, and it's actually assisting in elevating your yeast up. So All in all, you're looking at trying to cultivate a shubo that holds about 2 × 10⁸ total yeast cells. It's about 200 million yeast cells per milliliter. So the, let's say in a 100-liter shubo, you end up with somewhere around like 20 trillion cells, if that makes sense. And you don't want yeast to necessarily sit too long in this because it can be bad for them. However, specifically with Kimoto yeast, and I'll show in a second, it actually can withstand these stresses longer. So let's see. I'm gonna get through the rest of this and go to here. Okay. So sorry about that. That part was my least practiced part of this, and I apologize. I want to show you this because this is more important than anything, at least in terms of how we think of Sokujo versus Kimoto. When you're done with your shubo, you bring down the temperature, you leave it at a cold temp. And the reason for this is to kind of kill things off because all these stresses combined, you have a high amount of alcohol, a high acidity, you have theoretically your bame is at least 7 or 8, so it's like a gravity of like 1.25, 1.43, somewhere in there. And I'm sorry, 1.143. It's high enough that bacteria will not be able to survive this, but what's really interesting about Sokujo and Kimoto is you can actually maintain a much longer, the yeast will survive much longer at 10 Celsius, which is what this is showing, over a course of weeks. So you'll lose 80% of your cells in 2 to 3 weeks in a Sokujo versus 8 to 10 weeks in a Kimoto, which is completely different. You know, if you think about how important that may be for what you're doing in your fermentation, it's just incredibly interesting. Anyway, to me it is. All right, I wanna show you this chart, which you've all seen, and kind of just call out different yeasts and like what they actually are, different bacteria, excuse me. So these are the specific ones that we'd see in this early stage. So this is essentially a Kimoto fermentation. We have this first stage here where we're trying to, where random organisms are in there. We're gonna be trying to kill off some of those early ones. The two blue here, those are our lactococcus, our round-shaped bacteria, and these are our rod-shaped bacteria. This is how it's normally shown, and we're gonna get into a little bit in a second, but this is not necessarily, and in fact, this isn't even actually the most normal way this occurs, which has mostly been a research we've had lately, but I wanted to show this is typically how we think of it as nitrate-reducing bacteria, which produces nitrites for lactococcus to survive, and then this will take over from that, produce even more lactic acid, and then right smack dab in the middle, we put our pure cultured yeast, which already has a decent amount of cells, and then you can see just in a couple days, I mean, really, all of a sudden we have all the yeast we need. And then it's a matter of getting rid of everything else and dying off. So this doesn't really show what's happening in this later stage, which is why someone did a really cool study on exactly which yeast are present in here, which bacteria are present in here. And I'm actually kind of curious if anyone knows which brewery this was from, because it was a North American brewery in 2014. And I've been trying to figure out who that might be because they do not say what it is. I imagine it was one of the larger Japanese breweries in California. Could have been Sake One. I saw that shirt in here somewhere. But I'm very curious to know who it was to just learn more about the study. They did this at UC Davis. So let's see. So this is from a study that analyzed bacteria present from Koji all the way through the Moromi, and in two different Kimoto fermentations. And it might appear here that these bacteria, like, so this is lactobacillus, it might appear that these are actually alive throughout this whole thing. That's not actually what you're seeing here. This is a study by doing RNA analysis. So they're just checking for basically DNA present in these. But you can kind of tell when it kind of starts to level out here, that's about when those have died off and the cultures are kind of the same. But the actual reasoning for them being slightly up and down is more just the sample they're actually taking, not the fact that it's still there. They actually did say that these both finished at about 10% alcohol, so not very high. And I think this is why I wanted to get a hold of the person doing the study. I think they might have done that intentionally to let some bacteria live longer. But I thought it was interesting anyway. And then, let's see here. So what I wanted to show, though, was the influence of koji and how you can see that those cultures immediately translate over.
I have a question.
Yes?
How do you control the ABV when you're brewing a Kimoto-style sake?
Well, you control it with heat. You can control it with how much water is in it. I suppose it's the same fermentation techniques you'd use if you were doing any other fermentation. When you actually put in the yeast will matter too. So what we were talking about, like if you don't kill off certain bacteria here and there's certain nitrates or things like that still in, those would be poisonous to the yeast. And as a result of that, it will kind of inhibit yeast growth. So different stresses essentially are what you're talking about. You can stress the yeast by either dropping the temperature. So if you raise the temperature too much, or if you have too much sugar in the fermentation, that will also kind of inhibit the yeast. Different stresses you apply to it. The other way to do it, and sort of at the end of it, like when you're right here and you want to stop the alcohol from going higher, that's when you drop the temperature. And that allows you to stop alcoholic fermentation and kind of maintain the consistency and quality of yeast. Sorry.
So, yeah, I think the lactic acid bacteria are very sensitive to a high concentration of ethanol produced by a yeast. Mm. So that's why finally lactic acid bacteria die.
Yeah. And to that degree, I think that's why we see here, like even though this is showing this, it probably reached about 10% alcohol somewhere in here. And then after that, we wouldn't see any more growth of bacteria. But at first when I actually read this paper, it was not very clear. There's like one place where they mention that in fact all the bacteria had died. At first I thought this was insane. I was like, whoa, you're telling me that bacteria are just alive through the whole thing? So we disproved that, but it is an interesting graph. This shows actually where those bacteria come from. If I had an overall theme for this initial part here, it's showing you how bacteria enter the actual fermentation. There's a lot of questions about, oh, do they come in from the air? Some lactic acid bacteria do not typically aerosolize, so they don't usually like float through the air in quantities. They can. Most of it's going to come from your skin. It's going to come from your koji. It's going to come from things that you use. So this is actually a map. A bunch of different copy maps where they're showing you the concentration of, this is just a legend, but where all of these bacteria are showing up in a brewery. Now this is a North American brewery. I don't know which one it is, so I cannot vouch for its cleanliness or its practices. I just know that this is where they're getting these things from. And we can imagine if you don't clean your tools properly or whatever else, you'll be introducing these. And if you want to do Kimoto, that might be a great thing. If you're trying to do something cleaner, create a Daiginjo, this will be very helpful to you think about because you'll want to eliminate as many of those sources as possible.
Do you plan to get your own data eventually that you can have your own numbers and stuff like that?
I will say this, to do this, I've looked into a little bit of how expensive it might be. And even if you look on some labs, even to just do a single DNA analysis or even a plating, I think like $250. So a plating and then do DNA analysis, now you're talking like close to like $500 for one strain, every strain that they identify. So if you wanted to do, that's a lot. This must have cost them a lot to do at UC Davis. Or they have the equipment, so they probably do it wrong. Yeah, would love to, yes. It'd be really cool to do that, honestly, even at different sake breweries. It'd be a really cool thing to do. I put this up here because I was curious if anyone knows what this is. It's similar to the one we just saw, but I'm curious if anyone knows what type of fermentation this is. Shout it out. I already mentioned it earlier. That's why I asked the question. This is a lambic beer. And it looks very, very similar because it is very, very similar. It's the same thing with multiple parallel fermentation, often talked about as being the only unique to sake, and it's not. SSF is another word for it in the ethanol industry. It's for ethanol production. But anytime you're doing a simultaneous sacrification and fermentation, especially if other organisms are involved in the process of this, such as this, you can see that that will continue. This is actually, these things last forever. It's like 184 days, I'm pretty sure. And I would love if someone were to actually do this in the sake, like as a challenge to all of you, I would love someone to make a year-long Kimoto and let that baby ride. I don't know how you'd do that to keep the ethanol down, but it'd be an interesting experiment. But anyway, so I thought that was an interesting thing to look at. So what makes Kimoto yeast stronger? Sorry, these notes are hard to follow like this. So this concept of genes expressing themselves in different environments is extremely important in sort of how this all plays out. One of the most interesting fields of research is where you take an organism from one environment, you put it into another environment, and you tweak the parameters and you see what happens. In this study, this is a temperature difference in how they reared the same rabbit. And in one, when it was reared at 20 degrees less, or 20 degrees Celsius or less, it has these like extremities that turn black versus the other one reared above 30 Celsius. And I thought that was a fascinating study. So interestingly enough, when it comes to yeast, it's very difficult to study them in their natural habitat. For the sake that in order to study something specific, you have to isolate it so that you're not looking at it with all these other parameters. Otherwise, you wouldn't know what's actually happening. So one thing they do know is that yeast over the course of many, many generations, a very ancient gene in it, is that when it's in the presence of glucose at all, it represses the consumption of any other forms of sugar. So it just kind of like sits there eating, producing alcohol as fast as possible. You can kind of think of it like a kid in the candy store or like a two-year-old who just wants to eat dessert but won't eat any of their dinner. And that's actually kind of the metaphor plays out because, I'll get to that in a second, but it's an evolutionary trait if you think about it. They produce alcohol. Alcohol is poisonous to other organisms, right? So it's kind of a defense mechanism. And then they actually have an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase, which allows them to then eat the alcohol later for, you know, for food purposes. So all that's great, but there's, there is a catch, right? If you spend all the time just eating junk food, you're probably not going to be very prepared for when stresses come around, right? That's a huge challenge. In a Sokujo ferment, where you're just adding in lactic acid, that inherently creates this problem. So they're in an environment where they can just eat. And there are some stresses we can do with temperatures and things like that, but it's not necessarily preparing them as well as Kimoto will. So there's a study that was done where they basically put yeast into an environment that had glycerol, which is a non-fermentable, yeast will not ferment glycerol in the presence of glucose, right? Because it's gonna try to eat the glucose first. So what they did is there's another type of sugar very similar to glucose called glucosamine. So what they did is they put glycerin and glucosamine in this, and then they did another thing, and they put lactic acid bacteria with the same plate, so S. hominis is the bacteria there. And what ends up happening is, in the presence of lactic acid bacteria, they discovered that this thing, they call it a serendipitous accident. I love when these happen in science, when we just figure something out by accident. It was discovered that bacteria have the capacity to induce an epigenetic element in yeast. So what that means is they're switching a gene expression in yeast. And when they do this, so this shows, this image, just so you can see, this image shows that in a medium containing glycerol, non-metabolizable glucosamine, and lactic acid, it will trick the yeast into reversing its glucose repression and therefore successfully metabolizing glycerols. So glycerols are produced by, these fun little cartoons from a couple studies. This essentially shows this like specialist generalist, and I'll get to that in a second. But so when yeast is co-cultured with one of many lactic acid bacteria, this is about 30% of all species that can induce this, the bacteria will actually produce a chemical signal and induce what is now described as the GAR prion, a prion is essentially like a misfolded protein. It's actually what causes mad cow disease and a lot of other types of things. You don't have to worry about mad cow disease, but just noting it's the same general structure. And so it reverses that that gene repression. So in that case, what happens is it switches from a specialist that just eats glucose to now it's a generalist, right? And now it's actually able to eat lots of things. And one of those things is it will eat these glycerols. So glycerols are actually produced as part of glycolysis. This is actually like just part of it. What it does with the glycerol is it kind of just like offloads stuff into the cytoplasm or outside of its cell, just kind of like storage, really. It's not going to go back and necessarily use those as long as glucose is present. Koji also produces glycerols as well from lipase, so fatty acids produce it. But it's not directly. It's not just producing glycerols. It's done through its enzymes. Let's see. Glycerols are important, though. So glycerols are a type of sugar alcohol. It's like a combo, right? That's like how it comes through here. And more or less, yeast just make them. They stockpile them. I kind of describe this as a one-year-old who throws broccoli on the ground because it's very useful, but he doesn't want to eat it. So glycerols, why are they useful? So it's known to help yeast to strengthen their cell walls. It accumulates in the cytoplasm. Almost, you can kind of think of it as almost like a scaffolding. I think you said this. It's like a scaffolding to kind of like keep and maintain a structure in the presence of different stresses. It prevents cell rupturing. It allows cells to maintain important functions, like passing things in and out of cells. Like there is at some point a physical thing that occurs, which would prevent cells from actually doing their normal osmosis and whatnot, and this will prevent that. That's what I want to say. Okay, so this shows our roided out Kimoto yeast that have become super strong and able to handle all of these various stresses. So yeast, like most organisms, possess an ability to adapt to their environments by augmenting their own cell walls. They have social responses, which we don't have time to get into, but you should definitely Google social traits of yeast. Even flocculating is like a way of protecting each other. It's super cool. They have a rather short reproductive cycle. So this means that if you have a trait that suddenly is something that could be passed on, very quickly, lots of different child cells can have this trait. And there's a few ways that can happen. We all know about DNA replication, right? So your DNA will split and two different organisms get the same DNA for the most part. There's a type that can pass this change to a daughter cell. So if your yeast is being cultured with lactic acid bacteria and this change occurs, the cytoplasm, when it splits, can pass this to both the daughter cell and obviously stay in the original cell. So that's how this can pass really quickly in a lactic acid fermentation. Okay, so this is showing that here. So you have a non-genetic inheritance is where it's not being passed through DNA. You're just seeing it kind of like show up in both cells after they separate. And this goes back to, this creates stronger yeast because they've been all roided out like this. They have all these additional protections in their cell wall. And now this goes back to that chart where it shows why they're able to actually last longer, like where that comes from. Does that make sense? I'm sorry I've rattled through that, but does that actually make sense? Like, there is this co-culturing that essentially changes a gene expression that beefs out these cells and ultimately ends up allowing them to sustain a lot more stress in a high sugar, high alcohol, low pH environment. We want to talk about what might change the flavor of Kimelta. Why is that flavor different? So some things you might have read out there are that it's due to the way it's made, which is kind of a general thing. Flavors develop toward the end of fermentation due to strong yeast in a high alcohol environment. In other words, like stress is inducing this flavor change, or that Kimoto makes more amino acids. And some of these things aren't wrong, or they're just more like to get to the bottom of why. So I'm going to reference one of our guild members, Aaron, who has been helping to collect a lot of information. He wrote, he kind of collected a bunch of words from around the internet. These are the kind of ways that Kimoto's flavor is typically described. And I wanted to go through these descriptors a little bit, but there are many aspects of flavor that we can focus on. But for the sake of time, I'm going to discuss just the amino acids and maybe like peptides in sake. As far as most of the descriptors out there go of what causes the flavor of Kimoto, I would highly recommend for anyone brewing or selling Kimoto that they read Aaron's paper. He's going to publish it, I think, in the next couple months. And he really just digs into a lot of these studies, and I think he did a great job expressing how we arrive there. So I want to talk about amino acids and how we experience them. So amino acids and peptides are kind of like nature's spice rack, in a sense. Without them, things will taste a little cleaner and lighter, and in abundance, they do taste richer, and you might even say, you know, umami, you might say funkier in some cases, but I think that has more to do with other types of bacteria influencing them. So amino acids and peptides are created by proteases that come from Aspergillus. They're created by yeast during glycolysis, and Kimoto bacteria can also contribute to a pool of amino acids as well. But before we get into that, I want to talk about this. So most of what we learned about taste perception on the tongue has been dispelled by modern science. For instance, we do not have specific areas on the tongue for specific tastes. It's more so there are areas that might sense it more or less, but for the most part, it's kind of like a general sense of the tongue in various different ways. So some of the parts are more sensitive, but I'm gonna skip over that. You can think of it kind of like a piano, right? So like, I don't know if this works, but I think of it like this, right? When an amino acid or anything else hits your tongue, it's kind of like playing a chord in your taste brain, right? So you're experiencing a particular flavor from that, and it can either create consonance or it could create dissonance, or it can create a harmony in the way that you experience that flavor. And we don't obviously have any time to get into how we perceive flavor totally, but it's just kind of a high level. That's kind of what these things are doing when they hit your tongue. So Chiaki had brought something up to me when I was working with her, and I've been trying to learn as much about this as I can. I think it's really fascinating that most amino acids that we experience in nature are going to be L-form amino acids. This is just what mostly occurs in the natural environment. So when you consume things, you're mostly tasting these, and I've tried to outline as best I could in red which ones are bitter, and in yellow which ones kind of will hit your tongue and register as sweet. So in Sokujo, while you will also have some of the other form that I'll mention in a second, largely this is what you're going to be tasting. In Kimoto, it opens up a whole new category of things which are known as their D enantiomers. And I'm going to get into that in a second. So how we experience amino acids in Kimoto. So what's the chain? Blah, 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 blah. Okay. The reason this works is because of the co-cultured lactic acid bacteria. Kimoto has access now to a new enzyme that is produced by lactic acid bacteria. It's called racemase. And some people pronounce it racemase, racemase. Basically, it creates this form of racemization, which is to take one amino acid from one form, and Chiaki did it with these hands. That's why I thought it was cool that someone else showed it this way too. It basically is a mirror image of an amino acid. And when it hits your tongue, the reconfiguration of that is going to trigger, instead of a bitter response in many cases, a sweet response. This is why you can have a beverage that is like a dry Kimoto, but it tastes sweet somehow. It also gives, we also have peptides that are involved in creating that mouthfeel, but this is where we have a big switch in why these two are inherently different. They're called stereoenantiomers, basically. And lactic acid bacteria can not only produce these, but they can also take up existing amino acids and put out the D amino acids. And let's see. So get into like one last part on this is I want to talk about peptides for a second. It is often said that Kimoto contains a higher amount of peptides, which contribute to an overall mouthfeel, silkiness. It can actually contribute to bitterness as well. This is partially true, but not to the degree perhaps in described. You can see kind of where the peptides kind of end up over here on the top there. This is comparing Sokujo and Kimoto. So I'm going to quote Aaron again because I thought he said it really well. In the high amino acid Kimoto environment, the yeast preferentially take up amino acids over peptides. So right here, you can see that coming out of Kimoto, the amino acids are higher. But due to the difference in having that quantity, it changes how the yeast actually take one up versus the other. I'm going to wait for you to correct me on that. So in the comparatively low amino acid Sokujo environment, the yeast take up more of the small peptides instead, leading to a greater decrease in their levels. And it is important to note that the differences between Kimoto and Sokujo in this case seem to be due to the differences of the Koji enzyme activity versus the yeast metabolism in response, to different pH and amino acid concentrations, not necessarily the presence of lab itself. So I consider this kind of a superpower of lactic acid bacteria in this relationship and how it does this. This is all about basically coupling all the research that I felt like I tried to do this year, and happy to continue doing the research, as it sounds like I need to in a couple of these. But I see a fundamental relationship between what I did last year with like Aspergillus, lactic acid bacteria, Saccharomyces, sake, and basically, it seems like this really, it's kind of cool witnessing all these symbiotic relationships and learning more about them. I think finally, the only thing I wanted to say on here was, I wanted to end on a fond memory in that regard. I feel a great sense of joy looking back on the days that I worked with Dr. Takahashi. Especially as she explained all these various things to me, and that was just a fraction of what inspired this curiosity in me. But in reciprocity, one day she had told me that I helped her practice her English, which feels like a very small, nice way to say like that I gave something back, where she gave it all to me, really. But I wanted to say that I feel like it is another way to say that the symbiotic relationships of how we all help each other through this and how we raise the ship, so to speak. It's something I want to continue, and any way that you can help me, any way I can help you, let's do it together. Anyway, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this session from the 2025 American Craft Sake Festival. We had a great time, and we hope you learned something new. To stay connected with the Sake Brewers Association of North America and be the first to hear about future events and resources, visit sakeassociation.org to join our newsletter, or follow us at Sake Association on Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn.